Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. And podcasts of prior shows are also available on that website under local programming. And you can look for Your Financial Choices. Today is January 8th, 2020. Congratulations, WDIY, for 25 years ago, starting on this day, January 8th. Very exciting. I didn't realize it was today, so congrats. The markets were up again today with the Dow closing at 28,745, the NASDAQ at 9,129, and the S&P at 3,253. We had taken a little hiatus, so we're back after 3 weeks, and tonight we are going to talk about the fourth quarter market review and investment education. We are live tonight. We will take your questions. Lori C. is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I'll do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. I have two guests this evening, Tim Roof and Connor Darrell, who are becoming frequent quarterly guests with us. Tim is a CFP professional, financial advisor, and vice president at Valley National Financial Advisors. He assists clients with comprehensive financial planning, including retirement plans, investment management, risk management, tax planning, and preparation. He believes that working with individuals and families on long-term planning and navigating financial options requires a relationship based on mutual respect and understanding. He also serves as a member of the VNFA Investment Committee, providing experienced in-depth financial analysis to determine appropriate investment opportunities for clients. Connor Darrell is an assistant vice president and head of investments at Valley National Financial Advisors. He leads the firm's investment committee and research efforts. It's his job to provide investment analysis and assist VNFA's advisory teams with portfolio strategy and asset allocation. In this role, he meets frequently with representatives from global asset managers to discuss their views about the economy and financial markets. Connor is also a CFA charter holder. Welcome back, Tim and Connor.
Good evening. Thanks for having us again.
Yeah, thanks, Lori.
You've recovered from all the holidays. Everyone doing well?
Still recovering, I feel
still
like.
Still recovering, and our listeners maybe as well. So you could sit back and stay tuned and listen to our topics tonight. We're going to weave in some education as we go through the show. We think it's important to kind of cover the markets and what's going on, and we're thankful to have this opportunity to have Tim and Connor join us quarterly moving forward. If you do have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. So tonight, with this quarterly investment recap, we're going to talk about, as I mentioned, some education topics. But can we start off with what went on in the markets over the last couple of months? Can you give a kind of a quick summary?
Sure. So really 2019 and Q4 as well was a strong finish to the year and a banner year for both stocks and bonds. For stocks, I think the most noteworthy headline was probably that the U.S. and China finally arrived at what they're calling a phase one trade deal. And while the specifics of that deal itself have yet to really be fully disclosed, the market didn't really seem to care about a ton of the details as much as it cared about the fact that there was some sort of measurable progress between the two sides. Technology stocks in particular during Q4 were a benefactor of that because of kind of the easing tensions led to, you know, some concerns over restrictions on commerce between technology companies in the U.S. and China being lifted. So there was kind of a cloud of uncertainty that was lifted over those tech stocks. We really probably haven't seen the last of that trade volatility or trade-related volatility in markets, but the Phase One deal was definitely a key driver of performance during Q4. But even beyond that, we started to really see some further improvements in the economic data globally, which definitely also played a role in helping markets drive gains. Germany in particular surprised to the upside and narrowly avoided recession last quarter. So markets seem to kind of be pricing in or the expectation that Germany was going to fall into recession, and them managing to kind of skate away from that definitely was an upside surprise, which helped as well. So there's still some structural issues in the European economy that a large chunk of the developed world really preventing them from generating robust economic growth. But I think right now the market kind of cares a little bit more about the rate of change than the absolute value of growth. And there's definitely been a little bit of an uptick. So that's been good.
Good for the stocks. What about bonds?
So bonds finished off an incredibly strong year for most global bond markets in both the investment grade quality space as well as the high yield bond market space, as we saw rates travel downward over 2019 calendar year. Rates had dropped in the U.S. Approximately 1% during the year, which helped support bonds, drove bonds higher, as well as when we were coming into 2019, yields were a little bit higher on bonds, in addition, being that the Fed had basically gone through its interest rate hike process. And then in 2019, the Fed had stepped off the gas of tightening monetary policy and is now what they call a kind of a mid-cycle readjustment, where they started to reduce rates throughout the 2019. We saw three rate reductions, and that helped support the bond market. So bond investors were quite happy with their bond portfolio this past year.
And can you explain, though, why that happens? What? And I know we've talked about this on shows before, so people can always listen to podcasts, but can you just talk for a minute about the interrelation in lowering the interest rates, what that does to someone's bond?
Yeah, so interest rates and bond principal value move inversely to one another. So when interest rates rise, bond values drop, or when interest rates decline, bond values increase. The reason for that being is when interest rates increase, like they have in the past when the Fed was raising rates previously up until 2019, you could get a bond in the market for a higher interest rate. So the bond that you would hold is at a lower interest rate. So now your bond would lose value over that time frame.
So if you were in a position where you had to sell your bond, some people will hold bonds to maturity. But if someone was in a position where they had this bond that was at a lower rate than someone could get in the market and they had to liquidate, they're going to get a lower price in order to kind of help that person who's interested in buying kind of be fair value to what's going on currently in the market.
Yes, that's what would happen.
Yeah. Okay. So good. So it, inversely. So that's good to know. So stocks, after such a strong year, we gave some summation of why that happened. And it's always important to kind of look back to where we were. What about looking forward into 2020? I know it's just January, but...
Yeah. So it's certainly true that after such a strong year in 2019, I think was the strongest year since 2013. So it's been quite a while since we've had such a significant gain in the stock market in one single year. But just really by a product of starting point, the long-term outlook for returns moving forward is going to be lower as a result of how strong things were in 2019.
So we shouldn't expect to see the same kind of returns that we saw in 2019.
Right. But generally, the good news, though, is really that from an economic standpoint, there's actually been a little bit more optimism than there was coming into 2019 because, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, some of the economic data that firmed up a bit. So there's a little bit, obviously, you think back to last year, at the end of the year, end of 2018, mm-hmm. There was a significant drop in the market mm-hmm. because there was concerns that the economy was slowing down at the same time that the Federal Reserve was in its kind of hiking cycle. And there were really some worries that, that those two things together would potentially create some major issues for the stock market, and that kind of reversed itself over the course of 2019. So there's a little bit more of a more favorable backdrop, but like I said, just from a productive starting point, there's certainly the opportunity for returns is going to be a little bit more moderate. But the other thing I think is really interesting between the last couple of years is that if you think about over the long run, stock market returns tend to be closely tied to corporate earnings growth. But if you look at 2018 and 2019, there was a divergence between corporate earnings growth and stock prices. So in 2018, earnings growth was very high because we had tax reform and there was some healthy economy fueling the way. But stock prices were actually down. Then you go to 2019 and it was the opposite. There was really not much earnings growth to be had. It was kind of, things were kind of flat, but you saw the stock market take off. So when you take those 2 years together in one measurement period, it was that kind of rule of thumb that corporate earnings growth and the stock market kind of track each other holds true. But if you look at them independently, there was this big divergence, which I think is kind of an interesting phenomenon. Moving forward into 2020, the general consensus on Wall Street is that analysts are expecting anywhere from 7 to 10% earnings growth. So I think we're probably going to need that in order to sustain the levels of returns that we've kind of come used to having over the past 12 months. But I think it certainly is definitely an improvement over where we were from a corporate earnings standpoint just 12 months ago.
Okay.
I would also just mention it's probably important to note that 2019 was a relatively benign year for volatility. We were coming off of fourth quarter in 2018 where the markets went into bear market territory for a very short period of time, meaning they dropped at by 20% at one juncture. And then 2019, as we talked about, was a very good year, but we didn't have much in the forms of pullbacks or corrections during the year. So now that we're heading into 2020, it's an election year. The primary elections are coming up. Historically, the markets would suggest that the first 5 months of the year could be a little bit more volatile than the rest of the year, meaning it could just be a little bit more choppy from start to finish. We might see a bit of a pullback at some point of the year. But overall, as Connor noted, the economy is still growing, earnings growth is still expected to grow. So that's overall a very good backdrop for the economy and the and corporations and stock market.
Okay, so when we see the earnings growth and more confidence in the market, even with expected earnings growth of 7 to 8%, I think you said, what are we looking for? When we want to invest in the market and stocks, are there any deals out there to be had?
Yeah, it's been hard to find what someone might refer to as deals, but I think in general, the way that we kind of would approach it is from a valuation standpoint. Ways of looking at how the stock market is valued in terms of how good a deal you're getting, so to speak. There's a common metric used, the price to earnings ratio, which basically just compares prices to earnings, like we talked about earlier. And right now, that the ratio between prices and earnings is about 18.4 times. Whereas the historical long-term average is something closer to 15.2. So there's a little bit of a premium there. Things are looking a little bit more expensive on a relative basis. But when you look through history, valuation and that metric, and along with many other ways of looking at valuation in the stock market, is a really ineffective market timing mechanism. So I wouldn't really consider that necessarily actionable information in and of itself, but it's something to kind of consider because it does speak to, like we mentioned earlier, kind of the starting point being a little bit higher.
So there would be a lot of criteria to look at when trying to, whether you're choosing an individual equity mm-hmm. is what we're talking about here, because if you go into a mutual fund, hopefully someone's looking at that for you. So if you're looking at individual equities, that should just be one of the criteria, maybe the PE ratio. The
right. It's just one way of evaluating how cheap or expensive a stock or a basket of stocks is.
Okay. All right. You guys, we had a call on, she's off air. Mary in the Lehigh Valley called with a question off air. And she said, getting close to retirement, the general rule of thumb for thrift savings plan, which could apply to 401ks or 403bs as well. Thrift savings plan is just another type of qualified retirement plan. She wants to know if there's a general rule of thumb for thrift savings plan regarding risk tolerance. 5 years or 3 years out, should she get more conservative? So she's thinking maybe if she retires in 3 to 5 years, should she get more conservative? And what is the general rule? And I'd like to say I'm not a fan of general rules necessarily, but what is the general rule and what percent do you generally recommend? So Tim, and do you want to take a stab at that first and then Connor can weigh in and then I'll weigh in.
Sure. So let's try to break this into pieces. So we have the first question was, is there a general rule of thumb for asset allocation as you get closer to retirement? So there are a lot of variables that can go into this. So there isn't always a general rule of thumb for these types of as your circumstances change over time, because it's going to be based off of what are your income needs, how much have you saved over time, what sources of income will you have during retirement, what will you need to draw from your portfolio, and the longevity of your portfolio over time. So there's not necessarily a rule of thumb. You know, many folks, or we've seen, stick or have had used a balanced or moderate allocation as a starting point, and then may reduce risk over time. But again, that's not a general rule of thumb, as your personal circumstances will really drive your risk tolerance and your asset allocation.
Okay.
Yeah, and what I would add is one way to approach it is looking at kind of when you're approaching retirement, you take a look at where your accounts are and which accounts you're going to be drawing money from first are probably the ones that you're going to want to be the most conservative. So if you kind of think about after you retire, where's my income going to come from? Maybe from some Social Security, maybe a pension, what have you. And then you kind of have to figure out, okay, this account A, I'm going to be drawing from for the next 5-10 years maybe. And that's the one that's going to be the most conservative, because that's the money that is going to be near term. And longer term assets, you have the ability to endure periods where the market's going to be down. Whereas if it's a shorter time horizon, you don't really have the capacity to handle that, because you want to make sure that money's there for you.
Okay, so Mary, we hope that helps you. You had said, should you get more conservative? And I think Tim addressed that as far as, looking at your, not just your time horizon, 3 to 5 years, but what are your other sources of, what are your income needs, meaning how much are you spending? What are your other sources of income that could be fixed, such as Social Security or pension? And what is your, kind of time horizon a little bit for longevity, I would expect. And then to Connor's point, which I think is very important, sometimes people think of their money as one bucket of money when you hear people talk about, 60-40 allocation or 50-50. Did I forget to take a break? I just realized I forgot to take a break. I get so excited about when we're talking about these things involved. But anyway, if you think about it more in terms of the bucket of the stream of money that you need, as Connor said, it's easier to be able to kind of compartmentalize the risk tolerance needed for a particular bucket. If you know that you have a 20-year horizon and you have enough money that's going to kind of pull you through those 20 years, but for 5 years, you might only need to pull the excess or the additional amount you need over your Social Security or pension to meet your cash needs. Maybe that's, $150,000 and you have $500,000 portfolio. If you know that $150,000 could be set aside very conservatively, it helps you compartmentalize when you see what's going on in the market to kind of know the difference. So, Mary, I hope that helped. We are going to have to take a quick break, which we'll do right now. Stephanie, please hang on the phone, because we will come back to you as soon as we get back. Folks, we will be back in just a minute. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We have in the studio with us this evening Tim Roof, CFP professional, and Connor Darrell, CFA. And we are talking about the markets and doing a little bit of investment education, but we're welcome to take your calls as well. 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us or off air, whatever you're more comfortable with. But we have Stephanie right now on line one. Hi, Stephanie. Can you hear us?
Yep, I can hear you.
Hi, great. Thank you for calling in. How can we help you?
I had a question for you. So my dad is getting older, and he has a savings account, not significantly large. He gets a pension, and he gets Social Security every month, but he's getting older, and he's just getting a little worried when he gets older if he has to ever go into a nursing home, what would happen with all of that, because he would like to leave my brother and I some money, which is why he's creating a savings account. But he was talking to one of his friends, and I think he's just nervous that if, God forbid, he ever has to go into a nursing home, they're going to basically deplete everything and leave nothing to my brother and I.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to know what the best way for my dad to maybe invest some of it or gift it to my brother and I to leave some money. I don't really know what the best course of action would be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Tim, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Go ahead and start and I'll fill in the gaps.
Stephanie, first of all, just so you know, we've had a number of shows on what we call Medicare planning or elder care planning, and you can listen to some of those podcasts on WDIY.org under local programming. We've had a couple of attorneys from a law firm, Vasiliadis and Pappas, who've come on and they do a lot of work in that area. But mm-hmm. simply put, the welfare, but typically when we talk about elder care planning and protecting assets, we're usually talking about kind of, the word just came out of my mind. You kind of almost impoverish the person in order to kind of retain the assets. They have to give up control. So if that person, first off, isn't willing to give up control of their assets, then there is a chance that if they end up in a nursing home, those assets will be used up. So if you want to kind of protect some of the assets, you could start transferring some if your dad is willing to do that. But mm-hmm. the Department of Public Health will go, or Department of Welfare, excuse me, will go back 5 years to look at those transfers that were made, and it may have to come back in.
Okay.
So if he survives a transfer for 5 years, then those assets would not come back in. Sometimes people will use, you know, trust to do that. Where I get nervous sometimes is sometimes this elder care planning would, as I said, to kind of impoverish the person, it sometimes causes a lot of tax issues up front that you may never end up seeing a benefit from. So if we've seen people who sometimes have retirement accounts and they may be told to liquidate them, well, mm-hmm. if you take all the money out of a retirement account, you might have a huge income tax consequence. And if the person doesn't survive 5 years anyway, then, you know, that could be a big hiccup. So while someone's really healthy and young, and if your dad's got longevity on his side and he's only 78, he certainly could start gifting to you guys, and he could gift it to you, which means he gives up all control of it and he shouldn't expect it back. But you guys might have a family agreement kind of thing on the side that says, you know, you're going to kind of, yes, you understand dad gave you this money. It's yours. You can do with it what you want. But you're just going to decide on your own that you're going to kind of set it aside for him should he need some care. Tim, do you want to add something?
And that's
if you gift it, though, mm-hmm. can't they still go back 5 years and look and see, well, why did you gift it to her?
They can go back, but if you've passed the 5 years, then they can't go back beyond the 5 years. So if you start at 78 and he lives to past 83, you're through that 5 year look back on that money. But, you know, when I see that you say dad has a pension and Social Security, both of those are going to stop if anything happens to him. Those monies would be available to pay for some care. But, you know, it might just be his savings if he doesn't have a retirement account.
Right, right. And, and Lori made a good point with the 5 year look back. What there is there's a calculation that basically says gifts that are made over the last 5 years, there's a calculation that would state what period of time Medicaid would not kick in for to cover those long-term care services or those skill care needs. So that's why when Lori mentioned, hey, you may have agreement on the side to say, keep this aside for dad just in case he might need it because of that 5 year look back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like
we did, just really quick. So when my mom passed away, 7 and 8 years ago now, when she passed away, I ended up creating the savings account. It's in my dad's name and my name. So I should have, when we first made the account, I probably should have just put it in my name. But if I take his name off the account, they would still look at that too, right? Because it's in both of our names. If I just drop them off and just say it's mine, that's still
well,
account,
in
right?
Essence, then he's gifted half the account to you.
Okay.
So that would be back on probably half that.
Right. And then if you change the titling to just your name, then the clock starts on the other half of those assets at that point in time.
All right. But Stephanie, it's probably good to kind of start thinking about that. I think it's great you guys are all having a conversation about it.
But you
might want to talk to, you know, a lawyer and make sure you have everything else in a row, like the, you know, power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, a will, proper beneficiary designations, things like that. All right.
Okay.
Good job. Good luck. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I also think Stephanie's question brings up another good point is gift tax related rules. And just to mention from a gifting standpoint, you can gift up to $15,000 to any individual beneficiary per year without having to file a federal gift tax return. The federal gift tax return is administrative in nature that you would have to file to show that you're using up a portion of your lifetime gift exemption.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Now, the gift exemption for current year is about $11.4 million, so you wouldn't have a gift tax, which is why Tim said it's administrative. But it's also important for Pennsylvania inheritance tax purposes because Pennsylvania does look back 1 year, and they allow an exemption of only $3,000. So that's also something important to note. So good questions tonight, folks. So to continue our discussion about the market and what's going on there. And again, people, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. It doesn't have to be about our topic. Our number is 610-758-8810. Let's talk for a minute about international markets, Connor, because you mentioned earlier about Germany and how it was close to a recession, but they seem to come back, and that kind of helps the overall nature of how we're all feeling about the markets when we hear that other countries are doing better as well. So what can you tell us about this improved economic data in Europe?
Yeah, so, and I think some of the issues that have been at the bottom of what Europe has struggled with and much of the developed world has struggled with over the past years and year plus is similar to what some of the things that have troubled the U.S. as well. When you think about kind of the trade uncertainty, things like that, we saw some weakening in manufacturing activity, which was a little bit concerning to markets for a period of time. That has started to kind of bounce up a little bit.
Was that because of the trade tensions?
Yeah, it's probably a big piece of it because when you look at kind of global manufacturing companies when they're trying to make decisions about where they're going to be investing in new productivity and new workforces, they have to kind of consider what their cost structures are going to be. So when you have talk about tariffs and things like that, they have to consider what that's going to look like for them. If they're going to open a new plant in Southeast Asia, then they have to consider what the import costs are going to be on the goods that they produce there. So a lot of times when businesses are faced with those types of uncertainties, they'll kind of opt to kind of just stand pat and not do anything for the time being, kind of a wait and see type environment. And so we saw some of that net activity kind of dropping down a little bit. We saw some contraction. But in Europe, we actually had a recent manufacturing number that came back, and it showed that manufacturing was in a small growth period again, so which is good. It had previously been in contraction. So that was a nice bounce, and that was something that I think was celebrated in markets. But generally, I think, generally speaking, we talk about diversification. It's important to have stocks in your and bonds in your portfolio that are exposed not only to the U.S. economy, but to international markets as well.
Okay. Folks, we are at the halfway point. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY offers many choices and real voices.
This is Rosalie.
And Steve.
Join us and other hosts each Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. for Swing Sunday, a great mix of swing, big band, and classic vocals.
WDIY is the Lehigh Valley's local source for NPR news, public affairs, and diverse music at 88.1 FM and streaming on WDIY.org.
This is WDIY 88.1 Lehigh Valley Public Radio. The time is 6:31, and now time to get back to your financial choices.
Thank you, Mike. If you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Lori C., and she'll write it down and bring it into us. We appreciate the calls and the questions. It's the favorite part of the show for us. Connor, so we were talking a little bit about the international markets. Anything else you wanted to add to that since I cut into your time with the break?
Yeah, I think just building on what I was getting at with talking about diversification, wanting to hold stocks and bonds that are global in nature, not just in the United States, just helping with portfolio risk. I think the one thing that I would note is that while we have had this improvement right now, and the other benefit of holding international stocks right now anyway, we were talking about valuations earlier, valuations in international stocks, we're talking about the PE ratio as one means of measuring that. The valuation looks a lot fairer in international markets when you look at that metric. And as we said earlier, that's not necessarily indicative of what's going to happen over the short term, but generally over the long term, that's a pretty helpful indicator of forward-looking returns. But part of that has to do with, it may look cheaper because there are more risks there. As we talked about, a lot of the rest of the world has had a lot more difficult time than the U.S. in emerging from the global financial crisis and the recession that ensued. So they've been struggling with, stagnating economic growth, where the U.S. has been able to kind of climb out of that a bit, and was actually in a period where the Fed was able to start increasing interest rates. Interest rates abroad are still very close to zero and negative in a lot of cases because the central banks haven't felt confident enough in the economic picture to start tightening again. I think the other piece of that and one other driver of kind of long-term economic growth to consider, and this is something that applies to the U.S. as well, is demographics. When you think about GDP growth and over the long term and things that can drive economic growth, when you look across the developed world, there are some structural kind of headwinds to generating long-term economic growth. And the biggest of that is probably kind of the aging population. When you think about kind of what that means, is generally when you have more people retiring and approaching retirement age, the labor force is going to shrink because you have less people entering the labor force than there are leaving. So over time, generally, that leads to lower potential economic output because you have less people producing things. Hmm. Japan's been dealing with that for a really long time, and they've had a really tough time with it. And I think the other thing to add, globally is kind of on the flip side, you know, the only place in the world where you can really find those sorts of long-run economic growth stories is in emerging markets.
Can you, like, for our education of our listeners, what is emerging markets?
So places that don't have quite as much infrastructure developed in place. So places like India is a growing country. China is still considered an emerging market. So kind of these countries that are a little bit less developed than say, the United States or the UK or Germany, those are the areas where you see a lot more of that population growth. That's where you don't have those kinds of demographic headwinds that I was talking about earlier. But at the same time, you know, those markets are a little bit more risky because you have more geopolitical concerns. Mm-hmm. Think that the governments are a little bit less stable. So just like everything else in investing, you know, the long-term opportunity may be greater, but there's also more risk associated with it.
Okay, great. Geopolitical risk you just mentioned. And recently we have had some concerning news as it pertains to the tensions between the U.S. and Iran. So how do events like what we've seen developing over the past week impact portfolios? Should we be concerned about that?
So we have those discussions regularly about geopolitical risk as it does come up from time to time. And as we have those discussions, and then 3 months later, and 6 months later, 9 months later, you could see most times it's just a short blip on the radar or a small blip on the radar, because geopolitical risks do cause volatility. But as long as those occurrences don't cause functional issues with the economic fundamentals moving forward, then ordinarily the markets will just continue to get back onto their longer term trajectory. So we would, you know, normally suggest to follow the economic fundamentals and not what's going on a geopolitical basis, because the economic fundamentals tend to show where the economy is coming from and where it may be going. And when you look at the economic fundamentals, there's several factors that we do track or we like to track, and those being consumer spending, business profitability, employment, inflation, and the Fed's policies.
So I want to talk more about those in a second, but I just want to go back to a minute for the geopolitical risk. And you know how my mind works. So we're thinking, when we're normally building a portfolio, you're looking for diversification. And diversification is one of the biggest drivers for return, right? Diversification. So if we think about geopolitical risk from a diversification standpoint, sometimes we have to remember that geopolitical risk might be one small region of the entire globe. So that's why we don't want to disrespect geopolitical risk or, you know, tensions that are going on in particular countries, because, you know, there could be valid reasons that they have them or whatever it might be, but that it's the reason it doesn't always necessarily impact portfolio or your investments as much is because we're a global economy, we have diversification, and it might just be in one small area of the country. Is that a fair statement to say?
And yes, I would agree with that. And I think
so again, I don't want to disrespect anybody's geopolitical, you know, the risk that countries might be having to kind of grow, like we see in China or India and tensions in the Middle East or whatever. It's some of that's growing pains, I would say, you know, but.
Yeah, I think the way that we would approach something like an event like this, where it's, you know, obviously disturbing on the surface, you're seeing, you know, weapons and explosion and everything, bombing force at bases and everything. But when you look at, you want to kind of take a step back and think to yourself, okay, what will this do to the economic picture? And when we kind of go through the five, kind of, we call them pillars that Tim mm-hmm. laid out, you look at consumer spending. There's not much of an impact there. That's probably the strongest piece of the economy right now is the U.S. consumer. You go to corporate earnings. We talked about there's an opportunity. Expectation is for growth this year. So that thing that area looks relatively benign. Inflation still remains below the Fed's target. It stubbornly remained in check throughout the entire cycle. So there's some evidence, I'd say, probably in some areas of the economy that perhaps there's an opportunity for inflation to start ticking up a little bit. But that's probably not a major concern. Then you go down to Fed policy. The Fed has kind of signaled it's in a holding pattern moving forward. We don't anticipate any major changes to policy unless there's a significant change in the economic picture. And when you think about where the interest rates are, they're still very in an accommodative position. So it's not a situation where we would be concerned that something the Fed would do would unwind the bull market.
Okay.
Yeah, and when you look at geopolitical risk, some of those risks that could affect the economy, and these are just some examples, could be, for example, cyber warfare, where it could really affect the heart and soul of the financial economy out there. That could definitely cause implications to the overall economy. Other items could be raising of tax rates, both individual and corporate tax rates, that could also constrain the economy. So those can be some levels of geopolitical items that would cause constraint to the economy moving forward. But right now, when we look at those from a U.S. perspective, tax rates are quite historically low. Corporate tax rates are low. So those are very supportive policies for economic growth currently. And with the de-escalation of tensions with China regarding trade, that's once again taken that or helped reduce the uncertainty surrounding that, allowing companies and managers around the globe to once again make their decisions for the long term.
I'm sitting here thinking it hasn't been too many years since we were always hearing about pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, and the concern about were they going to go bankrupt. And we got the world got through that.
And it's amazing to think about that because if
it was so huge in the news constantly.
And I remember at one point of time, interest rates in Greece were creeping up there. They became very, very risky at that time because it was feared that they would not meet their obligations moving forward. Right. Now interest rates in Greece aren't all that different than here in the U.S. So it's really things can change very quickly over time based upon, how things tend to shake out. And that's why, we have these pillars to stick to help us stay on the straight and narrow, so to speak.
So the pillars, again, consumer spending, business profitability, employment, inflation, and Fed policy. So you're reviewing those regularly.
Yeah, that's something we track on a regular basis. Those are kind of the things that we think are at the foundation of what should be supporting a market. And, some of these things are what they might refer to as lagging indicators. Employment is one of those where, typically, jobs and companies are reluctant to lay off workers ahead of time. They usually that's something that kind of happens after things start to fade, but it's still helpful to get a picture of the employment situation because it really gives you another glimpse of the consumer situation, because those things are kind of tied together to an extent, because as long as people have incomes, they're more likely to be spending, and that's what really keeps the economic wheel turning.
Okay. We are in the last quarter of the show going to talk a little bit about some education topics around investing to kind of give people some definitions and things like that. So to kind of wrap up our market commentary tonight, Connor, what kind of overall information would you like to pass on to the listeners in general about the market? You, for example, for one thing you mentioned, we may not expect the same kind of returns we had in 2019. What other kind of discipline could you share with them for the upcoming year?
I think it, long-term, and I think it's just a reminder that investing is a long-term endeavor. It's not something that it's not really the best way to go out and make a quick buck. It's something that it's building the foundation of your retirement savings and laying the financial future for your retirement. And in that sense, that's why discipline is so important, because there's a lot of studies that have been conducted where you're just looking at market returns. If you were to sell after a huge decline, you know, it's unlikely that you'll be able to meet the same type of long-term return expectations that you would if you just stayed invested, because over the long run, the market does go up. It's just hard to really time those things. And if you're constantly getting in and out, you're probably leaving returns on the table. And the power of compounding returns is probably one of the most powerful rules of finance. So,
yep, compounding. I say let your money work for you while you're working and getting ready for retirement. Folks, we are at our last break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY, Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11, offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Welcome back to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I have in the studio with me this evening Tim Roof, CFP professional, and Connor Darrell, a CFA charter holder. And we have been talking a little bit about the markets, where we have been and what we're watching going into 2020. But we also thought we would like to take this opportunity to do a little education, because I am always surprised that people may not always understand some of the terms and definitions investment advisors use. And I never like to make an assumption that someone knows what we're talking about. So Connor and Tim, if you could kind of help us go through some of these definitions. So for example, individual equities is easy. We usually mean buying into a company, Coca-Cola, Apple, Facebook. You're buying more than a share. We're become shareholders. It's individual equities. A lot of people can't afford to buy individual equities. So hence arose something called a mutual fund. Explain what a mutual fund is, if you can, and how that has evolved into something called an ETF.
Sure. So as you noted, you have all the companies out there listed on the stock exchanges, such as Apple or Amazon. And if you were to purchase a share of Apple or purchase a share of Amazon, you are now a shareholder and owner of that company. So you have the right to participate in their growth, as well as any dividend or income payment that they pay out to you as a shareholder. And for some, that can work as a diversification strategy, but for others, it may not be plausible to just own one company, because you're tying your cart to just how that one company performs, and then you could be taking on above average risk, and it may be hard to monitor and obtain your goals over time if that company happens to underperform for whatever reason. So mutual funds came about where you have basically a wrapper, where they're a wrapper of stocks of many companies. These mutual funds can hold anywhere normally from 20 to 50 or even more different companies within that mutual fund wrapper. And when you own a mutual fund, you normally have a portfolio manager. So there's an investment company. That portfolio manager is making the investment decisions for you as far as which securities you would hold within that mutual fund and making those active buy, hold, or sell decisions within the mutual fund. And those portfolio managers may also have, you know, a team of people to help monitor that your portfolio or that fund.
Okay. Sorry, we have a caller.
Great.
I assume on line one, we have Carolyn from Sailorsburg. Let's see if we can get Carolyn on the phone.
Hi, I'm here.
Hi, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. How can we help you?
I have a quick story that I hope inspires some people.
Okay.
When we first got married, it was 1986, and we had just gotten married, just bought our first house, and really didn't have any money to invest, but it was in October of 86 that there were horror stories about the stock market. Okay. And things were going very badly, and I remember thinking, well, that's a good thing to stay away from. But after educating ourselves more and then, of course, getting a little nest egg to invest, we have really formulated a plan that's, you know, been flexible over the years as our horizons have changed, and it's worked out great for us, and now, you know, we're looking at retiring early, and I know somebody who had to work till he was 80 years old because he never formed a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just how important it is, and you were talking before about really sticking to it and trying not to get, you know, involved with the volatility that mm-hmm. happens at times, because mm-hmm. that's what it does.
Well, I think one of the most important parts of your story was that you said it was very scary in 1986, and you thought maybe we're glad we're not in that. But then you educated yourself and stuck to a plan,
mm-hmm.
and those are all key points that, you know, you didn't let fear drive your decision making moving forward. You let that fear push you into education and educating yourself, and now you feel, bottom line, that you're better off for having educated yourself and set up a plan for your own savings and retirement.
Yes.
Okay, wonderful, Carolyn. Thanks for sharing that.
Can I ask one quick question?
Sure.
It's about Stephanie's question before, uh-huh. and the five-year time horizon that they look back. Is that a federal thing, or does that vary by state?
I think it's actually varies by state because it's the Department of Public Welfare, and that and Medicaid is state-based, not federal. Like, I think there is a state, maybe New Jersey looks back 6 years now, I think I heard recently. So, you know, generally I tell people to talk to an attorney when they're trying to do this kind of planning because it's not in my wheelhouse.
Okay. Terrific. Thanks, Carolyn.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
So, Tim, we were talking about mutual funds. So it's a wrapper around individual stocks and provides some diversification. And exchange-traded funds?
Exchange-traded funds sometimes get pigeonholed as passive, meaning the exchange-traded fund is made to invest in the same things as an index, like the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones. So when you invest in exchange-traded fund that's based upon or positioned to reflect an index, that's the return you'll get minus whatever expense ratio there is for that exchange traded fund. But with an exchange traded fund, what you have is that you can trade that exchange traded fund just like you do a stock intraday during the open market hours, where versus a mutual fund, you can put in your sell order during the day, but you won't know the price that is sold at until 4 o'clock once they calculate the net asset value of that specific mutual fund. So that's the difference, idiosyncrasies behind the trading. But exchange traded funds have also changed over time as well, where now there are actively managed exchange traded funds that allow you to buy and sell exchange traded funds during the day instead of waiting for the market close to obtain that net asset value.
Interesting. So it could be, the initial steps to moving away from mutual funds then, if you have actively managed exchange traded funds that could trade during the day, that's a plus.
And
we might see more.
Well, we've actually seen more investment over the last several years into exchange-traded funds than we've had in mutual funds. So this is definitely a phenomenon that's been occurring for multiple years now, especially during this economic cycle since the 2008 recession.
Right. And the other thing I'll add as a difference between the two vehicles is that with a mutual fund, when you want to place that sell order, you basically submit the order to your broker, but that order goes to the portfolio manager who's running the mutual fund. And what they do is they actually have to go raise the cash. So they might have, 95% of the portfolio might be in stocks, but they have a piece of it that typically they're trying to manage those orders as they come in. And they'll actually physically go sell securities in the fund and then give you your cash. With an ETF, you can technically, since it trades on the exchange in the same way a stock does, you may sell your share to someone else. So there's no underlying trading that's going on necessarily as a result of your order coming in, which is something that's a little bit unique to ETFs and actually in a lot of ways reduces the costs.
So I think what you're alluding to a little bit too is that within a mutual fund, you may not always be fully invested as you would be in an exchange-traded fund.
Correct.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about individual securities. We talked about mutual funds, ETFs, and we talked about equities typically, but it could also be bonds, correct? We could have little pieces of bonds. So when we're talking about building a portfolio and we talk about diversification, how might using these strategies come into play?
So I think one way to look at it is we already talked about kind of the geographic diversification and diversification across asset classes. But Tim alluded to it a little bit in the kind of the difference between active and passive investing is another way to kind of the two different styles of approaching investing. Passive would be that traditional looking at investing in an index like he mentioned, such as the S&P 500, where basically you're taking out the decision-making process and deferring, basically saying, I'm not confident that I'm going to be able to outsmart the market, so I'm going to be comfortable owning this basket of securities, and I'll take that return that provides me. Where an active manager or active management process is actually going to be out there trying to identify stocks or bonds that the manager believes is going to outperform. There's a number of ways that they'd go about trying to make those determinations.
Sorry, can I jump in?
Sure.
So it's a little bit about maybe being a little bit emotional versus being not emotional at all. The mutual fund is more of the active management, and the ETF is the passive management. So the ETF is just going to follow the market, and that's that discipline. The mutual fund, you're hoping someone is kind of looking at
You're basically paying someone through the expense ratio in the fund to go out and pick stocks on your behalf. And there's a lot of ways they could do that. But historically it's proven that it's very difficult to beat the market because there's so many people out there buying and selling stocks. It makes it very efficient. The kind of the way that they summarize it is that the market reflects all known information at that instant, which is because it's just a product of how many people are in the market and how efficient it is. So it makes it very difficult to consistently beat the market through active management. But it is possible that people have achieved that. I'd say the main difference is if you're comfortable with the added risk that comes with active management, meaning, being different, the possibility that you would underperform the market by not necessarily making great choices relative to the overall benchmark. But that also gives you the opportunity to outperform as well. So it's a double-edged sword there.
So that could provide some diversification to have a little bit of both. We have just a couple minutes left, so about 1 minute. Do you want to summarize anything that you think is important around this little bit of education that we've given tonight?
I think one thing to add, we talked about diversification, right? So, I think a lot of times in talking with people, obviously if you turn on CNBC or the news media, it's plastered with reports about the Dow Jones or the S&P 500 and the returns on those particular indexes of stocks. But it's important to kind of consider measuring your portfolio against an appropriate benchmark, which may not be the S&P 500 mm-hmm. and may not be the Dow Jones Industrial Average, because maybe your portfolio holds half of it is in bonds. Well, it's not going to look like the S&P 500 if half your portfolio is in bonds. So I think it's important to kind of take a step back and make sure that you're evaluating the performance of your portfolio against something that's appropriate for that portfolio.
Very good point. Tim, anything you'd like to add?
It's a new year, so now's probably a great time to take a look at 2020 and, you know, take an allocation of, hey, what are my savings goals for the year? You know, what are my spending goals for the year? Am I appropriately diversified? Do I need to make any changes to my portfolio based upon my time horizon and my risk tolerance? So now's a great time to really peel back the onion, take a look at your personal situation, and stay on track.
Okay. To Carolyn's point about having a plan and sticking to the plan, but that means rebalancing, being properly diversified, and a new year is a great time to look at all of that. Tim and Connor, I know you're at the same office. Tim, if people want to contact you, what's the number?
610-868-9000. I can be reached at extension 113.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on, you guys. We really appreciate it. Next week, I will be joined by attorney Nick Nanovic of Gross McGinley to discuss trusts. When do they make sense? Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week, and thank you, Mike, and thank you, Lori, and thank you, listeners.
WDIY Allentown.